Good. I'm going to call the meeting to order. Is that all right, Joe?
Yes, you're all set.
I'm going to call the meeting to order. This is meeting number 23 of the Municipal Courts Task Force. We are on June 14, 2016. We are convened here this evening at 4 p.m., intending to run until approximately 5:30 p.m. So at this point, I will introduce. We have members of the task force. We have the Honorable Glenn Galbraith. We have the Honorable Betty Poole. We have Mark Solomon. We have the Honorable Scott Miller. We have Jason Leifer. We have the Honorable Gwen Wilkinson. And we have Ray Schlatter as chair. We have Joe Mariana, who is the county administrator, who is staffing this, along with, she'll probably arrive shortly, as Marcia Lynch, but perhaps not. So tonight, we have the agenda. I think in the main, we're simply going to be talking about the draft and any other comments that people wish to discuss. So with that, first of all, can we have an approval of the May 25th minutes, recognizing that whatever typographical errors or changes that anybody wishes to make along the way that are relatively insignificant, we will entertain by submission of the same to Joe hereafter.
So what do you think?
Sure, go ahead.
Thomas noted there will be little sympathy, etc. And I think what she noted was that there would be at least a little sympathy.
Yes.
Shipping costs back to the state. That's not typographical.
Yes.
It's
yeah.
Not here, and I think it's important that it be corrected.
That is correct. And that's accepted, of course. Any other changes, additions, modifications? So we have a motion to approve from Gwen. Any second?
Second.
Second by Mark. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Got it. All right. The next item is public comment. We have, at I believe almost every meeting, we've received public comment at every meeting, and at almost every meeting we have had speakers address us. Tonight, I understand that we do have Judge Jules Ravo, who has indicated from prior correspondence that he would like to address the group, and I would very much appreciate whatever comments he wishes to offer. So go ahead.
Okay. There's no one else here, though.
I did read his letter was circulated.
Yes.
Well, that letter was written probably about 4 weeks ago when I received the first draft of sections 1 and 2 of the draft report. I just really had a few comments. First of all, I'd like to thank the task force. I had a chance this afternoon to finally go through the minutes of the prior meeting, so I started back on. It was June 13th of 2015 when you had your first meeting. So I see the extensive work and the extensive time everyone has put into this. And I'd like to thank everybody for that. I think, you know, in reading the portions of the report that are available and in reading some of the, or most of the minutes, at least skimming through them today and yesterday, I see that a lot of the work is going to lead to some real coordination, I think, between perhaps the courts and certainly with the DA's office as well, which I think will achieve one of the goals of the task force, which is to somehow put together a system that achieves a little more equal results. I think the thing to take out of that is the fact that I think that's exactly what everyone has to do. All of the local courts should be communicating, and we should all be communicating with the DA's office as well to ensure that perhaps whatever unequal results are still occurring can basically be resolved. I with respect to the some of the recommendations, I don't really know much about the youth court or the LEAD program, but I saw like the improving the electronic access, which obviously is a great idea. In Dryden, we were using more and more email, and we also have a system now set up for electronic payments, which seems to be relatively popular, and more and more people are using that, even though it does cost them a small percentage. But they seem to be happier using that than always having to traipse over to court for either with a credit card or with cash or something else. Coordinating the court schedules, I think you guys have been working on that for a while now. I think there may even have been some changes with that. And there's no, you know, the ROR or the correct bail. My personal feeling is that all of the judges strive to come up with the correct result. I know from the first day that I started, I really spent a lot of time, especially driving over to the court at 12 o'clock at night, thinking about, you know, possible ways to handle a particular case. So I think all the judges really, I mean, everything that I've gotten from everyone throughout the local court system really, I think, spend a lot of time trying to figure out appropriate bails or ROR. The rap sheets at arraignment, I saw that there was some disagreement. I think, Mr. Schlatter, you felt that it is an absolute right for the defendant to
actually
receive the
it was CPL 16040.
Yeah,
it's pretty clear.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I was always reluctant because the rap sheets were always treated like they were gold, you know, and especially the village of Dryden. They didn't even want to give me a rap sheet at one point, you know. And then the state made a big deal about making sure everybody was fingerprinted so we could have access to the records that we needed. But I would agree that they do have a right to the rap sheets. I usually hold it, I'll read to them what's going on with the rap sheet. If they ask me for a copy, I give it to them. If they don't, I just hold on to it. Because some of the law enforcement people don't seem to know that either. And they seem to treat the rap sheet as like this piece of gold that can't be viewed by anyone else. But I would agree with you, it's definitely in the statute.
Sure, and to the extent it's necessary, I'll be happy to direct law enforcement. They're under an obligation to provide the court with two copies.
Well, I don't know if it's a matter of directing them, but just, yeah, letting them know.
Well, I'll remind them.
That's appropriate, because I don't think anybody, and when I started 2 years ago, I really wasn't aware of that either until I researched it and learned what I was supposed to do.
I had no idea it wasn't happening. I didn't know.
I actually have some information on that I picked up this afternoon.
Sure.
I can share it now or I can save it for
later. Let's go ahead. I mean, we're all among friends.
There are two different kinds of rap sheets.
Yep.
One's called the repository service, and it's sort of an enhanced rap sheet.
Right.
It has arrests and convictions, so it has more information on it. That document, we are not allowed to make a physical copy of it and give it. It can be seen by the defendant and defense attorney, but there can't be a copy. I said, well, that's ridiculous. You know, why shouldn't the defendant be able to see it? Prosecutor can see it, the court can see it. Why do they have to hand write out the information? It's based on a contract between Division of Criminal Justice Services and the Unified Court System. And they just have a contract that says that document cannot be copied. It can be seen but not copied. That's as opposed to the fingerprint rap sheet, which can be copied and should be copied and shared with the defendant, defense attorney. But it does not have as much of the information about what the person was originally arrested for, or what they pled down to, et cetera.
Is defense counsel entitled to view the repository document?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely?
Yes.
And the defendant?
Yes. They just can't have a physical copy of it.
Okay, but that isn't happening as we speak.
Well, I don't think the attorneys are aware of that either.
Right, I think this will help.
The attorneys do never ask for it.
They don't know the difference?
I always make the information available to them. Some of the attorneys will come in and ask for it immediately. And others don't do that. So,
what I was going to suggest, I think the difference, Glenn, between the enhanced versus the fingerprint, the rationale is, and I can almost figure it, you can almost see it, the contract probably is trying to be sensitive to the seal order provisions that are in place with respect to resolution of cases, so that you cannot, you know, the fact that there is an arrest there that might end up in a dismissal or an acquittal, that frankly, in my view, shouldn't even be on a rap sheet, but it is. It's on the enhanced rap sheets. It shows a dismissal. And so that clearly is information that should be sealed. And so there probably is a real concern about having that kind of a document floating around out there. It's one thing to be.
I understand that if we were giving it to somebody other than the defendant and the defense attorney, you know, they should have a right to have it. But I agree, it shouldn't go anyplace else.
Believe me, I have more disclosures.
Yeah. The bottom line is that's the state of things now, and I doubt it's going to change. But
how is it enforceable?
Well,
how is this private contract enforceable with respect to third parties who are not privy to the contract, not parties to the contract?
Well, here's how I think it would be enforced. If, in fact, they found that judges were giving these things out, physical copies,
to
defendants. They could say, you're in breach of the contract. Those judges, or maybe all judges, are going to be denied access to the repository rap sheet. We still have a right to the fingerprint rap sheet.
Or it could be a declaratory action of some sort.
Yeah.
In any event, great. Thanks, Glenn.
Okay.
Judge, so, anything else?
Well, actually, I do have... I wanted to start off on that positive note. I just to let you know, the other things here, I can skip over them. Decisions, confessions of judgment, partial payments. I mean, in Dryden, we're trying to do all of those things and have been doing them as long as I've been there, especially with the decisions. And I found how useful that was in a summary proceeding that I completed not too long ago, which was immediately taken to county court for a stay, and Judge Cassidy had the advantage of having a five-page decision with findings of fact, which assisted him in doing what I thought should be done in that particular case. So I mean, there's no question that decisions written decisions enhance the experience for all involved. I write written decisions in most, unless it's just an obvious small claims case, I write written decisions in those cases as well. And I think people really, really appreciate that. Partial payments we've always done. And the standardization of dispositions, which I think was the last item there, again, I think that comes into the idea of what you guys have been trying to promote here for the last year, which is communication between the courts, between the district attorney's office, and I've seen in these reports as well, talked about no policies, and I think the judges are moving away, if any of them did have policies. On a more serious note, with respect to, I guess one of the items that kind of upset me in a way was, I don't know what I did with that page. The entries on the, how did I do with that page? At the end of section two, one of the paragraphs says, I was happy to read, further, while there is general consensus that the existing town and village courts may currently function reasonably well, the underlying structure creates a potential for justice to be unevenly applied from one municipality to another. And I think some of the items here that we've just referred to would really take care of that problem. But then when I got down to the end, and I kind of read where to me, it was upsetting, I think, more than anything else. Inconsistent results in the administration of justice at the grassroots level in Tompkins County that raises fundamental fairness and due process concerns. I mean, we strive in our court to make sure that, that those are the two elements that are always carried out. And I've had discussions with most of the judges in the town courts, and I think everybody is really trying to get to that place, and everybody realizes that that's the whole purpose of our entire justice system. But you know, I wish people would come over to the court, and you know, and watch how we try so carefully to give everyone due process and a full and fair hearing. Another thing that was kind of a little upsetting with the report was there's a statement in there which says that the local justice court system has survived on the quote-unquote goodwill of a number of the justices. And I think it's a lot more than that. I don't think the report gives enough credit to the work that all of the town justices do, you know. Not only has the work expanded, but people are dedicated to their craft as well. You have, I mean, it's not an easy job, and people are trying every day to get better and better at what they're doing. So I think there's a little more than goodwill there. Certainly, 1 o'clock in the morning, goodwill is not high on my list when I'm going out to do an arraignment, especially if I know that I've been called out because there may be somebody who's looking to jam up a guy who refused a chemical test or whatever else, and so we're out there doing this. And even at that time, at 2 o'clock in the morning, you've got to try to be fundamentally fair and give the accused his fair share. On the funny side, what I found was in Judge Bauman's testimony, he talks about how the complaint rate against the local judges is 14%. The complaint rate against Supreme Court judges throughout the state is 89%, and the complaint rate against county court judges throughout the state is 133%. We're spoiled here in Tompkins County because, you know, we have a number of good judges. But I say to a lot of the attorneys and a lot of the younger attorneys, you don't know what it's like to appear before Supreme Court judges or county court judges that don't have clues to what they're doing. And I spent 25 years doing that down in the city and in the metropolitan New York area. And that would explain to me why there's an 89% complaint rate against Supreme Court justices or 133% complaint rate against county court judges throughout the state. But anyway, I just thought that was curious. I think some other things Judge Bauman raised was the cost of the entire system in Tompkins County is about $800,000. The proposal that I read with regard to the DWI court is close to $700,000 for that one court. And he also talks about the idea that, you know, people in the local justice courts can get rid of a bad justice after 4 years. You get a bad county court or Supreme Court justice, you're stuck with them for a very, very long time. That's not really a problem, I don't think, here in Tompkins County, but, I mean, who knows? We don't know. But, so the other thing I wanted to talk about, with your permission, is that first proposal, which is the DWI court. I respectfully have some strong disagreements with the statements that were made in that particular part of the report. First of all, the report says that the DWI court, or the concept of the DWI court, is supported almost universally by the existing judges. I would disagree with that statement. I know that. Well, I'm going to go on the record right now saying that I don't support the DWI court. I know Judge Clausen feels the same way. The last time I talked to Judge Dresser, he felt that way. I don't know about his co-judge. I know Judge Huddle felt that way. And I can't, at one point I had a tally of 9 or 10 judges that were not ready to relinquish their responsibilities with regard to driving while intoxicated charges and driving while ability impaired charges. So, you know, I would dispute the fact that it's that concept is universally supported by the existing judges. The second statement in support of the DWI court is that it will there's noticeably uneven results across the county. I had a problem with that statement as well for a number of reasons. First one was, in going through most of the commentary and the testimony, I didn't find really, really much, if any, evidence to support that particular statement. And I didn't do an extensive review, but I did do a review. And another reason why I don't support that statement is because I think that it's almost impossible under the present state of the law to have results which could really be all that uneven. Or certainly results caused by the local judges making a mistake or doing something, because the laws have become so extensive and so complicated that they've virtually eliminated all of the discretion that local judges will have. Certainly in any type of plea disposition, the little bit of discretion that still exists is really discretion, I think, that is reserved for the district attorney. I see it all the time in my court, because I really, other than deciding whether for an AI there's going to be a $300 or a $500 fine, there's really no other discretion at all. I know that some people raise the issue of some judges having this penchant for these five of these weekend sentences. I don't believe in weekend sentences, and I think the people at the jail don't want weekend sentences. But stuff like that can be cured in a lot of ways if that's the case. But I also note that the district attorney's office advised me of a policy a couple weeks ago with respect to requiring jail time for a dispositional reduction in some cases. So again, I don't think at this point that the local judges really have any discretion. The third part, because I know Mr. Slaughter wants me to move along here, is this indication that there's all this extensive paperwork. The paperwork consists of a conditional discharge, victim impact panel schedule, suspension or revocation, interlock device, and in the case of a refusal, which would actually be at the preliminary arraignment, in the case of the refusal. Those are the documents. In our court, they're prepared in about 15 minutes. Everything is on the computer. Deb Smiley, who did this for so long, when we had a case where someone pled guilty at the last minute where we had no notice of it, she could literally do those papers in about 7 minutes. And we would put the case aside for 7 minutes and she would knock out all those papers. So the idea of that there was some major time consumption, I would disagree with that as well. As far as the reduction of the caseloads, I see in Dryden there were 57 DWI cases, which would be 28 per judge, which would amount to a little over 2 a month in my court. On a DA night, I've got 50 criminal cases on. So if I reduce that by 2, I got 48 criminal cases on. So I think the work reduction load in the local courts would be insignificant. As far as the delivery of justice, in those cases, I don't think there would be any difference at the DWI court level, or certainly in my court. I had some other things I wanted to talk about, but I think I'll stop there with the record with respect to the DWI court.
Fair enough. Thank you, Judge Ravel. Did anybody have any questions or comments they wish to pursue?
I had a question.
Sure.
Thank you for coming and talking to us. You, at the beginning of your remarks, you made reference to, I think in support of, but I wasn't sure, increased communication from the local justice courts to the district attorney's office, and I was confused by what you meant.
Well, I was really kind of basing that on what appeared to me to be the spirit of the report, or the task force report, the idea that they're looking to promote communication. I only mean in terms of the fact that, and I had addressed this much earlier, way back in September, when I felt that there were uneven results in my court as compared to other courts. So I guess to that extent is what I mean by communication with the DA's office. In other words, so that dispositionally, if the DA makes one offer in one court but refuses to make that offer in another court, we are going to have uneven dispositions. But it's not going to be at the fault of the presiding judge, who in this case was me. It's going to be because that same particular dispositional offer is not being made.
Well, the court's not bound by the people's recommendation, as you well know. I didn't want to focus on that,
well,
though.
What I mean, Gwen, though, is if in one court you're granting an ACD and in another court it's a B misdemeanor for essentially the same factual matter, that's an uneven result, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't want to devolve into a discussion of how the facts of each case are. You don't have identical cases. But what I did want to point out, and this is something that we district attorneys are coming under the gun for, we can't talk to the judges about dispositions of cases. It's absolutely forbidden.
I misspoke if that's what you felt. I'm not talking about it in those terms.
Oh, okay.
And certainly you can talk to judges about the disposition of cases when you're here, the defendant's here, the defendant's attorney is here, and the judge is here. We can definitely have that discussion. And for a long time in my court, that wasn't happening either. So that's what I'm talking about as well, you know. And then certainly the district attorney, the ADA who's present, can talk to you about a disposition. He can talk to his fellow district ADAs about dispositions in the effort to really achieve, you know, because everything I see here says the justice court system is responsible for uneven results and the loss of fundamental fairness and the loss of due process. So if all I'm saying is that we're all in this together. And that's what this is all about.
Okay.
That the fault can't be laid at the foot of the justice courts with respect to this uneven distribution of justice, because I don't think that's the case.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to clear
my view on that. I did have one other point, which I thought, in going through the testimony, I saw, you know, I recognized the names of most of the attorneys who testified. I saw, a number of names. A lot of the testimony from many of the attorneys was not all that specific. It kind of went off in one general direction or another. And so it was difficult for me to figure out exactly what the specific claims of lack of due process or lack of fundamental fairness were coming from. But one interesting, and this will be my last statement, one interesting thing I found was a statement that basically said attorneys were not making motions and attorneys were not requesting suppression hearings or probable cause hearings because they were concerned or somehow were stopped from doing it because of their feelings about what the court would do with that particular hearing. And I found that I found I needed to take issue with that, because in my court, everyone is welcome to make any motions and do anything, you know, take every step that they need to take. And when people conduct the suppression hearings, or in we've had now a couple of probable cause hearings in the court as well, it's a great technique for disclosure. And I permit the attorneys to have as much leeway as possible in regard to that. It's a wonderful technique for disclosure. If attorneys are not availing themselves of suppression hearings or probable cause hearings, or they also mention they don't want to do a felony hearing, well, they're not doing felony hearings because I'm scheduling felony hearings in most of these cases. No one seems to want to do one. They're ready to accept whatever they get from the DA's office. So, you know, so I don't think it's the local court judges that are preventing that. Some of it may be simply the inexperience or unwillingness of the attorneys to go forward. I'm not pointing anything at any of the attorneys, but what I'm saying is they know they have every right to do anything they want. They're going to get a fair and full hearing in my courtroom. But those types of hearings are still not being requested on a regular basis.
Thank you very much for your comments, and frankly, I'm sure they will be woven into our discussion as we go forward, because many of the things that you touched on do address some of the language of the report. And I do want to make very clear, this committee as a whole has not passed on this draft. This has just been the work product of various members of the committee as knitted together by yours truly. So, some of this language is my language, and I take full responsibility for it. I've tried to capture what we had agreed and what reflected both the testimony and the representations made to this group by your colleagues, among others. So, but that being said, I appreciate that, and let's turn to the next item on the agenda, which is a nice segue. You have before you, as part of the chair's report, you have before you the current draft, which is a June 14th, 2016 draft of this document. There are many, many holes in it. It is a draft. It does include language that I'm assuming and would welcome discussion concerning. It does not fully complete Section 3, and it does not include anything with respect to Section 4. And I apologize for that. I've been working hard, but it's, as you can see, it's a 40-page document, and we still probably have another good 10 pages or more to write. So we'll get there. We're doing all right. But what I'd like to do is I give this to you and welcome any comments, any suggestions, any changes. Scott.
If you would permit me just to make some comments.
Please, yes.
I have to leave at about 5, so.
Oh, okay, fine. Good. No, go ahead.
Page 25. When I get the 2015 stats from Stop DWI, I will send those to you for the breach jurisdiction. And we have Citicorp, but I'm waiting on the others.
Okay, thanks.
Page 31. B, I'd like to suggest that it is expected that this DWI part will be centralized in either the Ithaca City Courthouse or the Tompkins County Courthouse. And then page 32.
So you want to be more specific as to a courthouse. I just said the City of Ithaca. I wasn't suggesting either a City of Ithaca courthouse or the county courthouse.
Uh, That's fine. When I read City of Ithaca with this document, it makes one think of Ithaca City Court right away. I just want to make it clear that we hadn't decided on, as this committee, that it was Ithaca City Court.
No, and I wasn't, I didn't intend that, so if you want to, because I'm not even sure it would be in either courthouse, they may put it in an annex someplace, you know.
Just a thought. And maybe the reason I thought you were implying City Court was when we go to page 32. Use of existing City Court space for chambers.
I did. And that's when I did go in that direction. That is correct.
I think that's what got me thinking that we were...
It just seems to me, based on what I can see, there seems to be more room over there than there does across the street. So,
yes. So use of existing...
And that saves us $20,000.
Austin County Court, so that's okay. So take, let's see. I don't have too many comments at this point.
Let me just, okay. The reason on the clerk's office is especially because it seemed to me that since the plurality of DWI cases are already being processed in the Ithaca City Clerk, Ithaca City Court clerks are doing the majority of that. They are, frankly, probably well equipped to absorb the entire load, and they are also employees of the Unified Court System, which would be an easy plug-in. And so there'd be part of what I was trying to suggest here is that we could use that shifting responsibilities among existing personnel to accomplish what we're talking about here. So. And since they are primarily located in the city courthouse, that's why I was suggesting that. But those logistics can be worked out at any time.
All right, page 37. Release defendants RR. So I had my suggested change is the following. Second sentence, in the local courts, often referred to as RR, for all non-felony charges should be the norm where the individual has no history of failures to appear. So I could live with it if we add where the individual has no histories of failures to appear. And then maybe add a sentence somewhere, maybe after oversight. Local courts, and I can email this to you, Ray, but I just jotted these comments down after I got the email. Local courts should be encouraged to articulate the mandatory bail factors on the record whenever an individual with only a misdemeanor is considered for remand to the county jail.
And where are you putting that in, Scott?
Maybe right after technological oversight.
Oh, okay.
I mean, we reference 5-10-30. Prescribed set of standards, but one of the issues is courts actually articulating it on the record.
Which will be handy in the event that a lawyer wants to take it for an excessive bail review.
Yeah.
And it used to happen frequently.
And it's handy when a court, if there's a judge out there that is inclined to remand too much, once the judge has to articulate it on the record, it reminds the judge, oh, there's factors, and oh, maybe I shouldn't put the person in jail. Maybe I don't want this to be appealed because the factors don't weigh in remand favor. So let's see. Page 38.
I'm going to push back a little on that because I don't want to dilute, I think, the overall message. I think the overall message is it is a very rare case that an individual should be required to post bail, frankly, in misdemeanor cases, period. I think.
Well, your next paragraph makes that crystal clear. At the top of 38.
In fact, I have a suggestion at the very end of Section 3 where we say OAR currently caps the assistance at X number of dollars. Local courts should not set bail in excess of that limit. And I wanted to add, absent clear evidence that the defendant is unlikely to reappear for court.
The problem I have with that, Glenn, is I don't know what it means.
Well, I do know what it means if we don't put something in there to modify it, because it says local courts should not set bail in excess of that limit. That means we never get to go above the OAR limit.
Well, this is our opinion.
Well, it's not my opinion. My opinion is that that is the norm, that I do not go above. In fact, the norm is no bail at all. They're set, right. They're ROR.
I mean, the starting point.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you do if somebody has half a dozen bench warrants in their past?
Then I set bail at a figure, usually within the OAR limit, figuring those folks are going to have more time to spend and determine if this person is really likely to show.
So you would support Scott's addition in the first paragraph?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. But I want wiggle room if I think the OAR limit is too low. I've got somebody with a really awful record and indications they're not going to show, and I feel I need to go higher. I want the freedom to do that. That should be a very rare occurrence. And in my experience, it has been a very rare occurrence.
Right, but it's one that you would be able to enumerate if you were putting the bail factors you considered on the record, right?
Absolutely. But if we don't modify that sentence, that says you don't go above the OAR limit.
Okay.
Period.
You know, these aren't capital cases. These are misdemeanor cases. And I think by shifting the burden, in essence, I think you've articulated that well, by shifting the burden to OAR, that does have better resources, perhaps, than the local courts to monitor and to ensure compliance. I think you're already implementing a level of additional oversight and constraint. So
I think you're right, Ray, but there are instances where I don't need a weatherman. I don't need OAR to tell me this guy is not coming back. And it's very rare, but I just want the exception available, as opposed to saying I agree that local courts should never set bail in excess of the OAR limits. Yeah.
No, I agree to some extent with that. The thing, Ray, that I would take issue with, a little bit of pushback, is that, you know, on an assault third, for example, where somebody's got a little history of, you know, harassment with punching and maybe an attempt at assault third in their background, they know that they could be looking at a local year. And it is a misdemeanor, but a local year is not nothing. And a local year will, in some cases, and left to the discretion of the judge who's presiding over the arraignment, it's a legitimate bail factor to consider the strength of the people's case and the likely, you know, what could happen.
No,
I just think in those cases that if a judge feels that there's a chance that they won't show up again, that bail's appropriate even on a misdemeanor. I might agree not on nonviolent misdemeanors.
I think what's happening is that we're basically just going back to the complete discretion in the court. What I'm saying is that we live in an increasingly constrictive society, even as a misdemeanor. So the guy runs. The guy's going to be found. They know where people are. People are found. People are picked up. The technology, whether they're getting a license or whether they're cashing a check or they're buying a phone or there's so many.
Ray, I tend to actually agree with that concept because just in my experience, I don't want to say what we do in Citicorp, but I can just, with that, you know, 5,000 cases a year, I would agree that where it's just a misdemeanor and the person has a few failures to appear, if bail is set at 1,000 or 2,000 and they post, as the court, I want to set a bail the person can post. It's a misdemeanor. Come on, it's a misdemeanor. If they don't appear, it's an immediate bench warrant, and that tolls the people's speedy trial time under 3030 with a bench warrant. They don't even have to exercise due diligence to find the person. That warrant hangs over that person's head, and if you want a real deterrent, that person is like, ooh, I guess I'm never going to go back to Tompkins County again because of that warrant that's out there. And there's money that's forfeited that goes to law enforcement. So I tend to agree with that concept, where it's not you know a sexual misconduct case against a child. It's a run of the mill misdemeanor. Bail should be set at a reasonable amount, even if the person is a flight risk and has numerous failures to appear. Like, well, okay, I guess they're going to forfeit their bail if they post the reasonable bail. So I don't have a major problem with that.
And not to presume on your gift here, the
I didn't know I did.
The fact is that whether the person posts $1,000 or is released ROR, the failure to appear is going to trigger a bench warrant, which will be not just circulated in New York State, but it's circulated throughout the country, and who knows whether it's throughout the world. But the fact is that anytime that person goes through airport security, anytime that person goes through, gets stopped for a traffic stop, whether it's in Pennsylvania or here or wherever, that warrant's going to pop up, and all of a sudden that person's going to be held in custody. Whether we extradite or not, there's another issue.
And 30 days after the missed court date, there's bail jumping.
And there's a bail jumping charge. So it's just
which are filed often.
So I just think we're...
Of course, by Brad. By
Brad's favorite charge.
I think we're being too... I know we're trying to...
I don't think we're that far off.
I think the other thing that comes up, and you know, for certain defendants, $1,000 means a lot more than to another one. And I think that part I've seen is not always taken into account in every court. For me, for someone like us, yeah, we could do that. But for pretty much every one of my clients, they couldn't do that.
No way. But
With respect, Ray, I think this is a writing problem, not a problem of fundamental disagreement. I think if the section begins with a more studied and neutral presentation about the purposes of bail, it will even itself out.
Maybe the local court should be encouraged to articulate the factors on the record.
I think adding language about this should be encouraged to articulate in writing, et cetera.
Not in writing. That's not possible.
Articulate on the record.
I would begin the section with a bit of an historical note, Ray, and you're perfectly well equipped to provide that. You know, the purpose of bail is broadly misunderstood.
If I were a town justice, I would take that as a direct.
I didn't say by town.
Judge Bravo would be sitting right back here again saying, then, I have a fourth
comment. The public broadly misunderstands the purposes of bail.
I think I've buried that point in the third sentence where I said the purpose of bail simply is to ensure that a defendant returns to court as scheduled. I think that's a straightforward, simple. I'm willing to put in language that says local courts should be encouraged to articulate on the record the reasons for setting bail in those, you know, few cases in which it's warranted or something like that. I don't think we need, Glenn, I honestly don't think we need to put in the absent clear evidence, because I think that's implicit in what I've just said, if you're going to set the bail.
I'm willing to go with just about anything, as long as there is an escape valve that I'm agreeing to somehow.
Well, let me look at the escape valve.
Yeah. I just want that escape valve in the one out of 100 cases where bail is even a potential issue, where I can say, in this case, I'm going above the OAR limit.
It would be the very rare case.
Absolutely.
Ray, you might not even get much objection if there was even a sentence in there that are recited along Mark's statement, the presumption of innocence. I mean,
well, the presumption of innocence is inapposite to the need for bail.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Because
the innocent flee as well, CF the fugitive.
That's right. One last thought.
Yeah.
Part of what we're addressing here, an important part of what we're discussing here, is quality of justice dispensed. And in a significant part, the quality of justice, as it is perceived by the citizenry who come before the bar is important. Now, if we have somebody who has jumped bail or not appeared for court, and particularly, as in my example before, it's, you know, one of my things, it's a violent misdemeanor, it's an assault third, I think we risk a perception that the justice system doesn't care about victims who have been injured. And as long as we're on the subject, an assault third, a statutory assault third, can be one hell of a beating. In the recent Jeffrey Horton case that we just finished trying, if you could have seen the slides of this woman's head, and all it was an assault third. That's all it was. And she was a mess. And to have the perception that, I'm not saying somebody should be held on bail simply because the accusation is they hurt somebody. But if there's a reason, they haven't shown before, they bench-warranted before, they mouth off in some way, and we've got a 71031A statement that is, you know, I'm going to be so far gone, you're never going to catch me, and what's the DA going to do, extradite me from New Hampshire? You know, this is not uncommon stuff that we have in our cases. And I just like to say that where there's some sign that somebody may not come back, particularly if the evidence is strong, particularly when the other bail factors work in favor of it, I don't think we should assume that zero is the starting point. Zero is one of the options under the statute. ROR is one of the options. So is RUS. It doesn't have to be money. It could be supervision. But that's not my point. My point is the perception of the quality of justice dispensed will be reflected in the kinds of arguments that judges, you know, accept or embrace when deciding whether or not to set bail. So
let me, I'm going to slide off that for a minute, but Glenn, if I added the word in the very last sentence, just put generally local courts should not set bail in excess of that limit.
That's probably very close to the language I put in my set of notes earlier, too.
You may have recognized some of this language, you know, it came from your notes. Here and there. And I think if we put in what Scott had suggested, should be the norm where the individual has no history of failure to appear, that is, I think, a substantial concession, but I think it would also perhaps tweak that. And then put in local courts should be encouraged to articulate on the record in those few cases where bail is warranted. And that might also respond a little bit to your point, Gwen, because I think we're capturing what our discussion was when we discussed this substantively. We basically said, look, CPL 51030 has standards. We want judges to follow those standards. We also want to avoid having people put in jail unnecessarily.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what we're trying to
do. The problem we're addressing here is real, Judge Rabo's comments notwithstanding. It's the problem of the stranger and the local person too well known by the court. And in both those cases, bail has been abused historically in this county. And we want it not to be done anymore. And I think that language, with those additions, will capture that end and purpose.
All right, Scott, did you have others? There are, but apropos of some of the things you said, I just want to pick up on that whole issue. I was trying to put some numbers. This going back to pages 30 through 31, 32. I was trying to justify or at least look at the numbers in a more direct sort of way as to, you know, the cost of putting in a DWI part. We know, I think that's a reasonably good number of $651,950, and then the offsets. And the offsets are, candidly, I just went through the testimony that we've received, and with respect to Judge Ravel, we did hear from folks who were saying that it was taking 45 minutes on average to process the paperwork. And I think part of that is it reflects not just the actual writing out of the papers, but it's understanding what is required in the papers in order to put the various answers in. So I felt when you took those calculations, you took the 340-some cases, you multiplied them by 45, you doubled that because, you know, that's just for the disposition. You've got probably another 45 minutes of time involved. You started adding up those hours. That's where you come up with the avoidance costs. In other words, if you have, and that's where I came up with some of those numbers that are plugged in there. I'm perfectly willing for somebody else to do other calculations, and I'm curious as to what, you know, the reactions are on those, because I want to make sure that those are accurate numbers. Scott, thank you. Thanks for your help on all this and your comments. So just give it some thought. I haven't reached out to Julie Hughes yet and assigned counsel, but Lance, you're right here, so if you'll take a look at page 31, we're looking for a number which, if we had a DWI part that was located here in Ithaca, the question is, what would be the annual savings in avoided counsel travel and court waiting time, assigned counsel? And there is some information that is somewhat suggestive of that $30,000 number, but frankly, I'd love to have a little bit more, something more solid on that. So if that could be, we'd appreciate that. The avoided law enforcement, again, it's less clear, but again, it's a question of waiting time, it's a question of travel time, transportation costs, that type of thing. So we need to come up with a number for that.
Ray, I'll follow up on that. Joe, down here.
Thanks, Joe. And then the avoided local court costs, again, you can see where it came from, 240 cases, looking at the and honestly, we need to look and see, but I was calculating that we're looking at basically, it's the equivalent of one town justice. It doesn't mean that one town justice is going to resign, but I'm just saying that the time to process 240 cases, if you start putting it all together, it works out to roughly the equivalent of one of the many town justices that we have, and probably one clerk, given their part-time status. So again, I'm interested in some feedback on those numbers. So anybody else have other comments elsewhere? And I know you just got this afternoon. We're going to reconvene again on the 29th, I believe. Is that 15 days? Yes. Wednesday the 29th. And I will make a firm commitment that you have it earlier than the 29th. It might be the 28th. I'll try to get it to you by the 27th, if we can, which is Monday, the final. But if others have some comments, I'd be glad to entertain them.
I haven't.
I was in deposition. So I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. And Gwen Stoppel, although she has been an enormous part of my education as a human being, she is not part of my syllabus.
Where do we put it?
Oh. You put me as the last piece of his education.
Well, just gonna prove, I think it does some injustice.
Oh, what happened to your writing? Where's your bio?
Was I out? Jason. Did you ask people to?
No, no. Jason submitted something.
I did with a poll for him, probably fine.
Okay. Well, no, did you send him something on me?
Yeah, I'm sure. I think I did.
I'm sure you did.
I have no history. I have none.
So that's my mistake.
I'll double check. No,
I'm
okay,
sure.
Okay, well,
you
if you need something, I'll write up something for you. Except I can't remember when I taught at the law school. I'll have to make that up.
Where did you get? Did you get mine from my website?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I took out the rutabaga curl because you know.
I did try to edit yours now.
I had one in there about twice meddling in the rutabaga curl.
Yeah, I think I may have.
Oh, nice. Will Sellers used to be in charge of that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I can take paper if you want. But
pardon?
Can we agree that each of the members of this panel his or
her yes.
biography, get it back to the chair.
Please.
With an eye to self-aggrandizement, is that going to be the organizing principle? Oh, okay.
Well, you have to put enough in there to make it.
All right, yours.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Gwen, because I know that Jason included it, and I'd have to...
Hey, no offense taken. It's nice to have a low profile.
Here, I can show you right here.
That's... Well, I was looking for, see if I could find your old...
Was that still up? I don't think so.
Well, I didn't hunt my last source. Would have been the Wayback Machine.
Well, maybe you didn't.
I can find all kinds of stuff.
I rescind my apology. I don't see it, Jason. So.
It's possible I didn't have it.
I'll write something up. I can copy the voice here.
Maybe he wants the
PDF. Well, I have heard that, but...
Okay, so we clearly have to deal with that. Page 5, all right. Anything else?
I've got a couple.
Sure.
I may have overlooked it in reading through it quickly, but one of the arguments I thought for the consolidated deed, which I think was helpful to me in leaning that direction, was the therapeutic value of having all these defendants seeing each other similarly situated and being treated similarly or differently where they did have differences. I thought that was a fairly important value of consolidating those courts. I think also Judge Bravo's right. I think we'd probably have to soften that claim that it's almost universally accepted by the existing justices. He mentioned names, and I know of a couple more who are not in favor of it. I think we've got to face that it's... I don't even know if it's sort of an even split on justices that are in favor or against.
Well, they're not. Are they unanimously in disagreement with it?
No, because there are some of us who think it's a good idea.
Yeah, okay.
But
I with respect to Justice Ravel, and I appreciate his comments, and I certainly recognize the names, but. This committee has discussed this, and we have heard from other justices who have, I think, stated pretty clearly that this is something that they would welcome, and I believe we have something from Judge Chernish that describes, and I'd have to pull that out again, but it describes the numbers. Do you recall Judge Chernish on that?
Well, I made no representation of numbers. I mean, the last time we talked,
what's that grid that you gave us?
There were some numbers.
Well, there were some numbers in that survey, but that survey only represented about 6 or 7 of the town justices. So.
But I thought, okay. I didn't realize. It was hard to read the numbers, but it was like 2/3 of them were in favor of this.
Yeah. I named 4 people and myself. And
no, no.
Galbraith says he knows of at least 2 more, and I will venture to say Dewey Austin and Dave Banfield and John Howell feel the same way. So that's close to 10. So you're right. There are people who went on the record. I know Judge Poole went on the record. She feels it's okay. Judge Galbraith said the same thing. But I don't think that it's certainly universal if you have
9
justices that are saying that we don't agree with.
Yeah, I will concede the almost universal because it's obvious that it's not. I mean, you're making it very clear. That was not the impression I think that this committee was getting, at least as we were discussing that issue. But that being said, I'm not going to quibble over that. We'll have to change that language.
Yeah, I think that's all I'm arguing is the language needs to be softened. Another thing, and this is really minor, is... the LEAD program, I would be inclined to list that number 2 because I think that in some ways is more overarching than even the mental health court and the youth court. In fact, I think both the youth court and the mental health court are sort of subsets of the LEAD program. But that's just a matter of style, format more than anything else. I just think that... I don't think anybody argues against the LEAD program. I think there's questions about the youth court and the mental health court being practical solutions. But the LEAD program, I think, might have the most impact of anything we do if that comes to fruition and it's bought into by many people.
That sounds like a great idea. Do others agree with that proposal? So we can rewrite that. We'll move LEAD to number 2, and we'll make youth court number 3. And as long as we're discussing that, do we want, we never did complete our discussion about the mental health court. There was somewhat of a, what we agreed to do was we said maybe down the road that might be something that should be further explored. Is it some language like that?
I think we do need to explore that.
Well, it could be a Section 4 item.
Right. I left it in there, as I said, add recommendation if the task force agrees, so.
I think I must have been out for some of the discussion because I don't remember substantive discussion about the mental health court, how it's envisioned to work. I beg your pardon?
There was a presentation.
Yeah, I definitely missed that.
That was Carol Booth and another woman were here. They talked about it's up in Auburn, it's up in Rochester, and
So it could be visited.
Oh yeah. I think the language that we talked about was it should be explored. There should be.
I had one other, and I think it's an issue of language, nothing more, and that is on page 39. Second, on the use of confessions and judgment. Before I read the last paragraph in Section 5, I added language in the last sentence. In no instance should a defendant be resentenced to jail for non-payment, then I added, comma, unless it is clear that he has the ability to pay but deliberately fails to do so, period. And then I read your next sentence and I said, oh, well, Ray dealt with that problem, except I don't want to be in a position where I'm forced to depend on the prosecutor filing a contempt of court charge. I'd like to be able to send a letter to the client and drag him or her back in without having to initiate a whole new arraignment process, et cetera.
And I'll tell you why I obviously I'm just one person, but I considered that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know what? That is, again, we're not dealing at a felony level. We're not dealing in federal court or anything of the sort. We're dealing at a very low level court. And I'm concerned that the personal animus of a judge who has had his or her authority flouted may in fact, in a very visceral sort of way, result in that kind of a response. And so my thought is, you know what? If it truly there's a flagrantly egregious contempt here that's occurring.
And ability to pay.
That's part of the flagrantly egregious contempt. Then pass it to somebody who's maybe a little bit more objective and have that person decide. And I know no judge wants to be told that their discretion is being challenged in some fashion or another. But I'm talking, again, we're talking misdemeanor court. We're not talking people who are, you know, we're not talking the folks that they send to prison for years and years and years and, you know, fine. You know, the Sheldon Selvers of the world, that type of people. So that's why I chose this language. I was very careful about it.
I thought maybe you were. And you have a point, Ray. And I'm not sure that I would not agree with it the way you have it written. My first reaction was, oh, gee, now I've got to basically convince the prosecutor to do what I think is appropriate. These situations come up so rarely that I would like to think that the prosecutor would do backflips to bring the person in if it is that bad. I'm willing to back off on that one.
If, for example, the sentence was a CD with restitution, and they don't pay restitution, then the prosecutor's going to file a violation of conditional discharge, even at the misdemeanor level, because, you know, there aren't too many other options. I agree with Ray with respect to the fines and surcharges. I don't know, it sticks in my craw a little about the restitution, because even though we're talking about misdemeanors, we may be talking about a property owner or somebody who's been done out of something that they can't afford to be done out of.
I know, but again, you're talking debtor's prison. Get them a judgment.
Right. Right. I mean, we can do a confession of judgment, but if they can pay and they don't pay, they can go to jail.
Well, sentence them, as you said, sentence them to a conditional discharge, the condition being that they pay this restitution.
Within X amount of time.
And my concern, I'm still... My concern is, I'm not going to back down on this one. My concern.
I hear you, but I don't agree with you.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
agree with it either.
Like what Judge Miller's done is he'll, with a conditional discharge, you can extend it for up to 2 years to pay restitution. And if at the end of it the person still hasn't paid everything, you can enter a confession of judgment for the balance. I mean, I had a situation like that come up like that recently. It had been extended for 2 years. We were coming up on the 2 year mark, and whatever amount was left over, we would have entered as a confession of judgment.
Here's the point, Gwen.
And it was someone who was indigent, and they were able to, you know, work here and there and pay some of it, but.
But the indigent person, we're not worried about. That person's not going to have anything happen to.
Right, but let me just tease out Gwen's point. If the person can pay, then the confession of judgment is collectible.
And once a confession of judgment is entered, who has to execute on the confession of judgment? The victim.
No. The court actually has the authority to direct the district attorney to enter the judgment, and it's up to the district attorney to then enforce it on behalf of the victim. There's no requirement that the victim alone be stuck with this.
So
it would be up to my office
to go and put a lien against their property.
No, there already is a lien. It's a judgment.
So I'll go take their golf clubs out of their garage.
No, you just turn it over to the sheriff. It's a levy. So the judgment is entered of record. By the way, it's not a confession of judgment. It's a judgment. You enter a judgment because the court has said you must pay this fine. You don't pay the fine, then judgment is entered. You just simply direct it. The court directs the district attorney to enter judgment. District attorney enters a piece of paper with the county clerk that says judgment is entered against Ray Schlatter for, you know, $1,250. Then, at that point, either the victim can go ask the sheriff to execute on it, or the district attorney on behalf of the victim can go ask the sheriff to levy upon the judgment. Go to the trust company, see Schlatter's bank account, and pay off this judgment. So, I mean, I think if there's ability to pay, the civil system will do its work, and the person will end up paying. Anything other than that becomes, I don't care how we call it, it's a debtor's prison, and I think it's just wrong.
And it's worse, because in the case of the marginally indigent, the upshot of that conduct on the part of the court is to guarantee indigency.
Well, and also puts too much, my concern here is that it puts too much. It allows, it's the near indigency is where the mistakes frequently are made.
Yes.
In determining ability to pay.
Well, I think in those cases then, I'm talking about situations where people have jobs. Maybe they have a car, maybe they have a
phone. And then take the judgment and levy against the bank again. You get 10% a week or a month or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's...
And they'll keep working so they can pay the judgment.
That's probably a good alternative.
Well, the other thing that this... The advantage of doing the confession and judgment, too, though, for the system is that you're going to take out, especially where a person was assigned to the defendant, mm-hmm. Some of the courts want us to come to the VOCD or just an appearance, you know, beforehand. Like, say the conditional discharge is up and... You know, in month 11, they'll want us to come in and they'll check the payment. And some of these payments on the fines or restitution are not all that much. But I had a case out in one of the courts where the judge had, I had to go out there about six times. So, cost exactly. It's ridiculous. I mean, it should have been. It was the kind of thing where we knew the person was not going to be able to pay from the get-go. The judge refused to issue a confession of judgment. I had talked about him with it from the beginning because, I mean, it was a family that the court had known.
Did the prosecutor join in the recommendation of the confession?
No, they didn't. And they were, you know, had these appearances happened at times or weren't DA days. Yeah, they weren't. And you know, and at the end of it, I mean, honestly, like most of the time I won't even bill these single appearances. But for this one, to make a point to the judge to see how much it cost, I did. And it was, I mean, I think for this particular one, there were possibly seven appearances on it. It was insane.
Yeah, that doesn't
count. Lance, you have something?
That's not uncommon. That happens in a number of cases. And it's a cost for assigned counsel. Because we, you know, if it's an assigned counsel case, we'll pay the trial each time. And judges are maybe going to try to get someone to pay, but then you have someone who, in those near indigency cases, and particularly where they're low income working, but they really don't have the money to, it's hard for them to come up with that money. And it costs, we spend more probably in a lot of those cases, you know, on applying a surcharge than ultimately on the defense attorney in the court than you're ever going to pull in.
Well, I had to appear on one for the person who didn't pay the DNA fee, and that's a $50 fee. For me to show up is $60. That's just.
I'll see Ray if we come up with a number on that. I'm not sure how well.
Right. Actually, maybe we can put a sentence in there on that as well, because that's a cost thing, which.
I mean, that would
lies with our charge here. So.
Maybe we could have the county pay. Be cheaper.
Be cheaper. Anything else?
I think the state should pay.
Yeah. By the way, I was right about those, my population numbers. I thought I was right, but I went back. Well, there's been a flip. So in according to the census data,
oh, right.
In the 1960s, we had 66,000 people in this county, and they had close to 198,000, close to, and then up to 101 in Chemung County. They had three judges, we had two. Made sense, you know, 3-2 or 2-1. Now, we have almost 105,000. We're just shy of 105,000, and they have 87,770. So, I mean, it's like remarkable how it's going
it
the other way, and they still have three, and we still have two.
Well, I think we should posse up tonight and go take one of their judges.
Well, perhaps. So I say Richie Rich.
I'll leave that up to. Oh, yeah, Richie Rich.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like him too. How come you and I both like the same judge? That's not good.
Well, because we have good sensibility.
Yes.
All right. Are there any others, items? Other.
I would just like to say something, Ray, with regard to the DWI court. I
sure.
think initially when this committee began, the judges were receptive to the idea. I think as we have progressed and the process has progressed, it has become an issue with the judges. I think back then they were open to what the task force had to say, and it seems that they're rather frustrated, and I can only speak for myself in that I have no position on it either way. I'm just here as a member, and but I can see where the judges are coming from. They just feel that once that starts, then it's just going to keep going to the point where, you know, everything is going to be taken away from them, and they've changed their mind. I mean,
yeah.
Simple as that.
Anecdotally, I've had that impression too. Not specifically, but people that seemed open to it or said positive things about it before are now not.
Exactly.
That's because the misdemeanor court is no longer on the table.
You mean the whole misdemeanor court?
The district court, yeah.
Yeah.
It may be.
Well,
it may be.
Maybe some other things too, actually. Is there
anything that you can point to specifically that, I mean, I appreciate the comments that have been made, and I think
Judge Bravo, and Judge Chernish, you know, they've had their pulse on this, and they get feedback. They talk to the other judges.
Yeah.
I try to keep them informed, I think it's been beneficial for me. But as I say, I think initially they were open to see what the committee would come up with, and as the process has evolved, they're more reluctant to agree with a lot.
Well, I suspect, I mean, and to be very clear, I suspect that there has been some pushback to, we've been very transparent in terms of this process and the rationale for this process. And I think that there are some folks who are very strongly in favor of a complete, not elimination of the local courts, but, you know, to go something along the lines of all criminal cases go to a centralized court. And I think some folks, obviously, there was a very strong pushback against that. So I think that the DWI part represented a rather unique area where there could be, in fact, centralization, because the types of points being made, I think Justice Galbraith just mentioned that, you know, in terms of, you know, that inducement, being in the same room where the other folks are seeing that people just like themselves are going through the same trauma and problems and scrutiny is useful. That there's a therapeutic value there. That's something that has probably been better articulated by Judge Miller, you know, and on the record in other discussions. But there's no question this report, as it has been drafted, has suggested that if we do that type of model for DWI part, that could become the template for other, you know, an expansion of that into other areas of the misdemeanor. And candidly, I see that as part of the handwriting on the wall. I also understand that we have 300 years of very rich history where it is unlikely to happen absent a constitutional convention. But so I get it, but I think that the issue for this task force is, are we going to stick with the recommendation, or are we going to, drift away from that? And I
just wanted to put it on the record to let you know, and as I say, as a matter of record, that I think that's where they stand. You know, it seems they've been demeaned throughout this whole process, and a lot of it is unwarranted, I must say.
I only want to respond to that, Judge, because frankly, I think every member of this group has been has huge respect for the justice court system and the amount of time. And for instance, one of the comments that Judge Bravo made about the goodwill or the good faith or whatever it was of the judges, that was not a slight. That was an accolade. That was basically saying, look, we are grateful. The only reason the justice court system works in that sense, the only reason it's economically viable in that sense, is because judges are willing to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they are willing to do the things that, frankly, we saw were not happening in the district court world down in Nassau. They have the lockup. They're charged after 6, they go to centralized lockup, they're not arraigned till the next morning.
And in the great range of cases, there are lots and lots of cases in which people in Caroline or Dryden or Mount Ulysses want their case to be heard by a judge. They help elect, they know, they have, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
But we're addressing a rather different set of concerns for equity, fairness, uniformity, consistency. And by the time you get to a DWI trial, a misdemeanor DWI trial, it's better that be heard not by a lay judge,